suggest.
Person, we can't say it's a man, okay. Can we?
Good afternoon. I'm opening a meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee on Thursday, March 19th, 2015, and welcome to all of you in attendance. I am going to be carrying over the work session on House Bill 2632 to next Tuesday, March 24th. Apologies to those of you that traveled here, and we're looking forward to that working it. We were looking forward to it as well, but the actual chair, Representative Vega Peterson, cannot be here this afternoon, so she'd like to be here for that. So apologize for any inconvenience. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 3050, Regional Air Quality Control, and I think we have Representative Lively. There you go. Yeah. Oh, there he is. I do. I get confused. Here, are you supposed to read the bill?
I can if you want me to, yes. Mr. Chair,
go ahead and read the bill.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 3050 modifies requirements for the composition of boards of directors of regional air quality control authorities.
Thank you. Chair Reardon, members of the committee, my name is John Lively. I'm state representative from District 12, which is Springfield. I'm going to make just a few comments in background to this specific bill. So the Lane Regional Air Protection Agency was actually founded back in around 1968. And if those of us that are old enough to remember, in 1968, especially in Lane County, but a lot of places in Oregon, Wood Products was the primary employer. And those wood products mills in those days burned all their wood waste in wigwam burners. And so much of what the Lane Regional Air Protection Agency was involved with early on is moving to clean up, quote, the environment, much of which was impacted by those wigwam burners. It happened to be at the same time this agency was started, I worked for a local manufacturing company called LJ Manufacturing. And while our business was sand and gravel, our company actually started building screens, wood screens, to separate the chips in that so we could start using the wood waste products in other manners in that, whether it be where they were. Because up until that time, they just dumped everything in the wigwam burner. So the agency goes back a long time, and it's the last regional air pollution authority, air protection authority in the state of Oregon. There were other regionals. This is the last one, and I can tell you over the years, the communities of Lane County, the city of Springfield, and the city of Eugene that were involved, and now Cottage Grove and Oak Ridge, have worked to maintain this regional authority versus relying just on the state for multiple reasons, but primarily so we have the local resources to work with industry in that to meet the standards that are required, the EPA standards and the federal clean air standards that businesses can operate. My years of working in economic development, this authority has been very important because we work with numbers of businesses that they worked with to help understand the permit requirements and the standards of which they had to meet and how to meet those standards in order to both create and sustain jobs in the county. So the history and why it's still there is because it plays a very important part both in the clean air of the area but also in helping businesses to be successful to meet those standards. So this bill, and I brought this bill to you because the board and the communities asked me to, and I strongly support it. The other thing they would say, I served on the board, I was chair of the board for a while, and so a lot of involvement with this committee. But what this bill does is allows, so it started off, it was Lane County, the city of Eugene, and the city of Springfield. Over time, as the agency stayed in place, it expanded from the standpoint, obviously, if you look at the airshed in our area, Cottage Grove, Oak Ridge are very important parts and have some of their own issues regarding the air. And so it expanded to include them, but for most of the time, once they were onto the board, there was one position. So the cities of Cottage Grove and the city of Oak Ridge shared one position. What this does, it doesn't add to the total number of board members. It only designates another position. So both the city of Cottage Grove and the city of Oak Ridge would have a designated position on the board. And there's a representative here from the authority and from the board and that to speak directly to that. But I'd be glad to answer any questions if you have those of me. Otherwise, we'll let them, the experts, talk about it.
Any questions? Go ahead.
Thank you, Representative. Appreciate you doing this. Just a comment, I guess, and then maybe a question. But, you know, in the old days, Yeah, they used to be wigwam burners. Now we call them biomass converters. So it's got a different terminology. We're trying to do it all over again. What kind of the irony? But tell me what kind of activities this board engages in. Do you have any examples, maybe of just actions they've taken, or maybe
yes.
There's other folks behind you that can testify to that?
Well, first, they are the permitting agency. So, Mr. Chair, and Representative Johnson, so they're the Air Authority permitting agency for the region, mm-hmm. for Lane County and Hampton. So we're in a lot of places. The state is doing it. They do it in our okay. site. They monitor, so they have monitoring sites in that to gauge and make sure that we're in compliance. And if they see traces or things starting to change in there, then they can work with the communities to start addressing what there are. So they test at the facilities in that. And I'll pick on the semiconductor plant and the semiconductor work there. So the agency worked very early with the location of the semiconductor plant to make sure both they understood what the rules were, what the impacts would be to the community. So monitoring the impacts to the community and then how they would fit in and what they'd have to do and the technology that would be available to do that. And then after that point, sure, you know, making sure that they enforce that permit and they're not exceeding. In that particular case, there was a monitoring site right on, given the size of the plant in it. So it's an ongoing monitoring. It's the permits and working with businesses over time to make sure we meet, in our region, meets the standards that are required under the Federal Clean Air Act.
Are there other boards of this nature around?
I don't think there's any in the state.
Not other in Oregon.
Right. No, this is the only one.
Other questions? Well, thank you, Representative Lively, for bringing this to our attention.
You're welcome.
Are you sticking around, or are you going to?
Who was it?
Are you going to stay around?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and we could invite Mr. Fleck, Mr. Denner, and Mr. Huff. And when you speak, if you could identify yourself for the record and about that far away from the mic or so, not too close, that'd be great. And whoever would like to go first.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mike Fleck. I'm a Cottage Grove City Councilor. I'm a citizen member of Lane County, and I'm a current chair of the LRAPA Board of Directors. With me today are Merlin Huff, our Executive Director, and Maury Denner, the chair of our Citizens Advisory Committee for the LRAPA Board. I'll just give you a quick overview. LRAPA's board has, by consensus, supported this. A little history is that Cottage Grove and Cresswell, basically all rural rural communities on that board, share a position. Currently, just Oak Ridge and Cottage Grove share those positions. Oak Ridge is facing some serious issues with non-attainment for PM 2.5 particulate matter. Cottage Grove is at the very southern end of the Willamette Valley, is impacted, you know, by activities to the north of us. We feel that it would be appropriate to have both communities represented. We did give you a letter outlining some of the details. I won't take your time up today to go over those, other than to say that the board makeup, in a sense, won't change. Eugene will still have four members on it. Springfield, because their population just went over 60,000, will have a second seat on it. With this proposal, Cottage Grove and Oak Ridge would have a seat, and then there would be still one at-large member to make it an odd membership on the board. The board membership would still remain at 9. I will say it's been my pleasure to serve on this board for, I'm beginning my 5th year. I absolutely support this agency. I will say that I was actually one of those skeptical members of the community when I first joined it, and through my membership on this board have grown to really appreciate, like Representative Lively mentioned, how this agency works with businesses to make sure not only they are successful, but that our air quality in Lane County remains good. With that, if you have any questions of any of us, we'd be more than happy to answer those.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Well, Mr. Huff or Mr. Denner, either one.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here, but we're here primarily just if you have any questions on this. Appreciate Representative Lively bringing this forward.
Oh, I'm sorry. I need to remind you to say your name if you decide to say something. I'm the temporary chair here. So,
Chair Reardon, members of the committee, I'm Merlin Huff. I'm the executive director of Lane Regional Air Protection Agency. Thank you.
Do you have any comments, sir?
I'm Maury Denner. I'm the chair of the advisory committee. Other than to say that the advisory committee is informed on the bill and supports it and is pleased to see it going forward.
Okay, great. Thank you for being here today. Any questions to this panel? Mr. Betts.
Mr. Chair. So the concept is, if this bill passes, what good thing happens for you?
What happens for us is Cottage Grove and Oak Ridge, I think I mentioned, every 2 years we switch positions on that. If there is an item that comes before the LRAPA Board of Directors that impacts one or the other city, we're relying on folks that live, I think as the road flies, about 90 miles apart. Do we still have the same representation for each of our communities? I believe we are both rural and would have similar issues, but based on the our geographic locations, I believe that there are different instances where there may be issues. This also would address if another city had some issues and wanted membership as well. It would allow that other city to rotate in as a representative on that board. There is, based on population, of course, a supermajority of Eugene members on this. I will say that those representatives do a great job, but I do think that the rural voice is very needed on this board, and I think that it's a very important addition to the board makeup.
Follow up.
Yes, sir.
So if the idea, though, is if you're there embracing, you're carving up the airshed, is that right, on this group? Allocating airshed, if somebody wants to bring a factory or something in and begin to use up space, if you needed to, we had this come up over on the east side of the state, and we wanted to bring in, I forgot what it was, but we had a challenged airshed. So is that what ends up happening on this group? Is it what's? I'm just wondering who has the votes to say, hey, we in Cottage Grove want to have whoever it is show up. We want to put more whatever it is in the air. And gosh, do we have the votes to do it? I mean, I'm just curious if this is what you guys do.
Well, that is a piece, but I'm going to defer to the expert on this.
Okay. Chair Reardon and Representative Bentz, the board itself is intended to be a cross-section of the community, so there's really not a division of airshed as far as any allocation of emissions or anything by board membership. It's really for having balanced decision-making for the entire region. But there are issues if an area has not met air quality standards. In the case of Eugene Springfield, for example, it used to not meet carbon monoxide standards or particulate standards, but over time those standards were attained, and then a maintenance plan was developed, and that outlines the process for new industries to locate there. And we've been able to successfully have new industries come and locate. Most significantly, in fact, that reminds me of Representative Johnson's comment about the biomass. We do have a biomass cogeneration facility that was constructed and permitted in 2010, constructed 2011, and has been operating, produces almost 20 megawatts of electricity using forest waste products and also residual sawmill byproducts.
And a follow-up was slightly different angle. So we banned, this building banned field burning, or most of it, 4 years ago. Has there been an improvement in your air as a result of that?
It, Chair Reardon and Representative Bentz, it certainly has reduced the number of complaints that we receive regarding field burning smoke. So as far as people impacted, it appears to, based on the number of complaints we receive, we used to receive several hundred, and we would forward those to Department of Agriculture because it was under their jurisdiction. As far as summertime air quality, reduce the average concentration in the summer. But our problems are, for particulate matter, are primarily in the winter. So our focused strategy in the winter is on trying to reduce wood stove smoke as much as possible. And Oak Ridge, that Chair Fleck mentioned, is the single biggest challenge for us right now. Even though it's only a community of only about 3,500 people, it's a tight mountain valley, heavily dependent on wood, doesn't have natural gas available, so it's dependent on either electric or wood. So that's been a very specific challenge for us.
In a follow-up, if I may?
Yes, please.
So what I really would like to see are the studies that show not so much complaint-driven. That's certainly understandable. That's an improvement if you have fewer complaints. But it sure would be great to see what actually happened when it came to the discontinuance of the field burning and how much cleaner or not the air got in that end of the valley. Where would we check to find that data?
Well, Chair Reardon, Representative Vance, the Department of Agriculture would have the overall statistics. Even when field burning was operating at a high level, they had an extensive monitoring network. They used our monitoring network to supplement their information. They would probably be the single best source to look to for that information. But even prior to the ban on field burning, the thrust of the program was to try to avoid burning on problem days and to try to avoid days when it was going towards the more heavy urban areas. And so our monitoring network that was part of that was in the Eugene Springfield area. So their plan was to keep smoke out even back in the day of field burning. So that may not show the dramatic effect that you're looking for. But Department of Ag would be the source of that information.
Yeah, just as a comment, Mr. Chair, I was just reflecting upon the assertions that were made back when the bill was being promoted that we probably could have disbanded your group had those assertions turned out to be true, because we were led to believe by some maybe over rhetorically challenged folks that if we would ban field burning, Eugene would become as pristine as Aspen, Colorado when it came to his air. And I'm just curious to see if that actually happened. I'm guessing not, but yeah.
Chair Reardon, Representative Betts, most of the complaints that we received back in that day from field burning were in the more rural parts of Lane County rather than in Eugene Springfield.
Thank you.
Just a couple of quick questions. Does the DEQ also monitor air in that area?
Chair Reardon and members of the committee, yes, the DEQ has an extensive monitoring network statewide, but in Lane County, we operate that network, and so our information goes into the statewide database. So we're part of the DEQ statewide database, but they don't actually operate the monitoring stations in our jurisdiction.
And one last question. Do you generate any of your own regulations or requirements that are maybe in excess of what EPA or DEQ might require?
Chair Reardon and members of the committee, LRAPA does have its own rules. We're required to be at least as stringent as federal and state rules. In practice, over time, as federal rules have become more detailed and improved, our rules are essentially the same as state and federal rules. There are some differences for backyard burning, programs like that. Certainly our wood stove programs are very specific to the communities they're designed to protect. So the Oak Ridge, the Eugene Springfield requirements on wood stove use and a lot of those programs are very customized to those communities. But if you look at industrial rules, there's probably more similarities than differences at this point between state and federal and LRAPA rules.
Second, last question then. Do you have any rules that we could draw upon, any information that we could draw upon to help us better address wood stove pollution in particular? If you
sure
do, we would love to have that information.
The key program that that you all are considering this session, from our perspective, is incentive dollars for wood stove replacement to speed up that process. As far on a day-to-day basis, we work very closely, have a very strong partnership with both Oregon DEQ and US EPA. So we certainly are sharing that information, but the yeah, the wood stove replacement is trying to get cleaner burning technology out there so we're less reliant on curtailment during pollution episodes. That would be a very significant advance forward, I believe.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions? One more?
Yeah, please.
I would just mention, Mr. Chair, that I think it's next Tuesday. I believe we're going to be considering bills pertaining to wood stove emissions and so forth. So I don't know whether any one of the three you might be available, but we would sure welcome your testimony if there are best practices or things you could share from what you're doing within your airship. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for coming up. Appreciate your testimony. Okay. Closing public hearing on House Bill 3050. And I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2946. Could you give us a little intro to that?
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2946 stipulates that the Public Utility Commission may authorize an electric company to include in its rates the cost of funding and implementing cost-effective energy conservation.
Okay. And let's see, who signed up for that? Any particular order that we care about? Oh, okay. All right. So how about we have Wendy Gerlitz and Jeff Bissonnette come up, please. Good afternoon. Just whichever one would go first, that would be fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Bissonnette with the Citizens Utility Board representing residential ratepayers. This bill represents an issue that I think is being raised kind of in the paired with the next bill, kind of on the general theme of keeping rates affordable. This the issue in this bill is one regarding the need to go after additional energy efficiency in the industrial sector. This is an issue that we at CUB have been aware of for a couple of years, and the issue sort of succinctly is that right now the there are two ways for the residential and commercial customers to go after efficiency. One is via the public purpose charge, which is 3% of your bill, and then the other is a clause in statute that allows the Public Utility Commission to identify and authorize collection for additional energy efficiency savings above the 3%. And what that's allowed us to do is go after the least cost resource, which is what energy efficiency is. It keeps rates down for everybody. When that authorization for the PUC was passed, it was part of a bill in 2007, Senate Bill 838, and so it's called, not coincidentally, 838 funding. There was a sort of a political decision made to exempt industrial customers from that requirement, and that was because that the 838 in 2007 was also the bill that established the renewable energy standard. And at the time, there was a fairly robust conversation going on around that issue. At the time, there was some hope that the industrial customers would support or at least be brought to a neutral position on the renewable energy standard, and we didn't want to give them something to throw out on the energy efficiency side. So we exempted them from that ability. Turns out that they opposed the renewable energy standard all the way through, so I'm not sure what we got for that. But what the situation that we're facing now is that the industrial customers are reaching the upper end of their share of the public purpose charge, and that is going to require or what that will mean is that there will be savings in the industrial sector that is the least cost resource, and we will not be able to go after those savings. You will hear this like, well, let's just move some money over from the residential or the commercial customers. That could be a possibility, but right now residential and commercial customers are paying somewhere between 5.5% and 6% of their bill on efficiency, which is entirely appropriate. A good way to spend that money being the least cost resource, and the industrial customers are paying 3%. And so if there were some more equality in what the customers were paying, we could talk about that. But again, when for my purposes, residential customers are paying twice for efficiency or paying in their bills twice what the industrial customers are doing, it's we already believe there's a subsidy in place, and we don't want to sort of continue that. This bill, well, first of all, there is a discussion going on at the PUC. It is still, I have to say, sort of frustratingly early in that conversation. We made a pretty big deal about this issue in the last rate case for Portland General Electric last year. As part of the stipulation to settle that rate case, we agreed to engage in a conversation about how to fix this problem. As part of that, we there could be regulatory fixes. There could be a legislative fix, simply removing the statutory prohibition on the PUC authorizing additional efficiency purchases in this sector. And so we put in place this bill, 2946, as a placeholder. In our view, it still is a placeholder until we sort of figure out something at the PUC. But the chair thought, and frankly I agreed, that having this conversation paired with the conversation that we're going to have on the next bill in terms of keeping rates affordable made some amount of policy sense. And so here we are talking about this bill. I don't frankly expect this bill to move certainly today or even soon, but again, it's my hope that we can make sure that we have a vigorous conversation at the PUC as soon as possible to make sure that we are not prevented from pursuing these very cost-effective resources. With that, I'll stop, and I'm happy to answer any questions at the appropriate time.
Any questions for Mr. Bissonnette?
You lucked out today.
So far.
Yeah.
Wendy, would you?
Yeah, Wendy Gerlitz, Northwest Energy Coalition. We are a nonprofit group that works to promote clean and affordable energy throughout the Northwest. I've been working in Oregon for the last 4 years on these issues, and I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to you about House Bill 2946 today. This is an issue that is very important to the coalition because it represents, as Jeff has pointed out, the least cost resource here in the state. And we are concerned that currently, due to the issue that Jeff laid out with the way that the existing law is structured, Energy Trust of Oregon is going to be shortly prevented from acquiring some very, very low cost, not just least cost, but the lowest of the least cost resource. The energy efficiency that's in question among the large users, industrial users, is on average about 2.5 times less expensive than the other resources that are acquired for residential and commercial customers. So this is some really inexpensive resource. The limits that they're reaching are in the territory of Portland General Electric, which we know is about to start their next integrated resource plan to look at replacement for the Boardman coal plant, and they're going to need resources, and this is a very low-cost resource that the Northwest Energy Coalition doesn't feel can be left on the table. So we need a solution to this problem. We have been raising this issue for the last 4 years, ever since I've been on staff, trying to work with the various stakeholders involved in this issue to get a solution, and we haven't seen a good regulatory solution put on the table yet. That doesn't mean seen that the process that's being initiated at the commission will not succeed, but frankly, I'm a little bit skeptical about how that's going to go. And so I wanted to make sure that I was here today to emphasize that this is a really important issue that is we're butting up against the deadline. Energy Trust of Oregon has said that this year they might have to leave resources on the table. The other point that I wanted to make is that these projects are projects that are being brought by these industrial customers to Energy Trust of Oregon. These customers are coming and saying, here's some ways that we think we can save some money in our business to make us more competitive, to save us on our energy bills, and to save all ratepayers money by saving this energy and allowing it, you know, to be redistributed in the system. So the customers themselves are bringing the projects to Energy Trust of Oregon asking if they can help. And so so it's a win-win, really, for everybody. And we just think that we really need to find a solution to this problem. So appreciate you allowing me to come before you today.
Questions? Rep. Mintz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do we have a list of those projects? Can we get them from the Energy Trust?
Well, they will not provide lists of actual projects because they keep the customer information confidential, and so they won't actually provide you a list of the projects. They do have examples on their website, which I would also be happy to download and provide to people, of past projects that have happened. But in terms of projects that are in the pipeline, because of the sensitivity to particular customers, they won't release that information.
Follow up,
please.
I don't have much patience for that, as you might guess.
Me neither.
So I think perhaps we ought to maybe amend this bill so we can fix that, because that makes no sense to me whatsoever. If we're going to impose these kind of costs and we don't know how the money is being spent, that doesn't make any sense. So the bottom line is we better do something to get that fixed, if you want my support for the bill. So let's set that aside for a moment. That's just my off-the-cuff comment. And let me ask this question. The assertion that you must have this, or we must have this money to do this good thing, is of interest to me. So I want you to explain more, and you might be the best one to do this. I need to hear again with much more clarity the benefit that you think we're going to actually realize should you get this increase. So you went by it pretty quickly, and I'm not sufficiently familiar with it to pick up on it, so maybe you could be more clear in your explanation for at least my purposes of understanding it.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Benz. First, before I spend most of my time on your second question, on your first comment, I have to say that it's not a matter that we don't know how the money is being spent. We have a very good idea of how the money is being spent. What the issue is, as companies bring potential projects to the Energy Trust, until sort of things are signed, sealed, and delivered, they are uncomfortable with having that information shared. Once a project is underway and is done, we have all of the information we need. But and I think you'll find that's pretty standard practice with, you know, even conversations that companies have with utilities about what they may or may not want to be doing, until an agreement is signed. For competitive reasons, for proprietary reasons, companies are uncomfortable with sharing that. So it's absolutely not a matter that we don't know how money is being spent. We absolutely do. What the question is projects that are being brought that are prospective that may or may not happen.
Before he leaves that point, Mr. Chair, a follow-up.
Yes.
Thank you. So I guess then what you're saying is we have a series of projects that have been complete that we could see right now.
Yes.
And there must be a boatload of them, because otherwise we wouldn't be out of money. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Benz, that is correct. We've done a bunch of projects in all of the sectors, have saved ratepayers over $1 billion, have saved over 450 megawatts in energy efficiency. So we've essentially built a power plant of energy efficiency, and that does equate to your term of art of a boatload of projects. The issue is that we have another boatload that are waiting, and unless we figure out a way to make sure that all customers are paying, we won't be able to access those projects and those savings. And that is a precursor to my next answer, but you have another question on this, and so I'll stop there.
Thank you. Follow up. Right. So I've looked at those projects, the $1 billion. What I'm interested in are the ones in the last year, mm-hmm. and not the total sum total of all the investment of all the public service charge. I'm not interested in that. But your assertion has been that we have a series of projects that we can't look at because it's too secret, and we have to look at the ones that are just passed. Those are the ones I'm interested in. I'm not interested in the huge pile of whatever the savings assertion might be. Mm-hmm. So for us to be able to see what you just did so we can then interpolate somehow what you want to now do is important to me. So is that available?
Yes.
As opposed to a large estimate, shall we call it gracefully, of what this program has achieved. I don't want that. I've seen it. What we need to know is, should we invest the ratepayers' money or these companies' money in what you now want, and the best way for me to judge that is to see what you just did. So that's what I want. Now, if you can't get it, then I guess I better ask the Energy Trust.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Benz, that information for the last year, for the last 2 years, is absolutely available.
And a follow-up.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the issue is return on investment of those projects. Mm-hmm. Not just a big assertion that we've saved billions. So we need to see the ROI on what you're mm-hmm. investing.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, my answer is second question, which I believe, if I remember correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, was what do we know is the benefit to ratepayers?
Exactly.
And the benefit is that utilities are in the business of buying power in order to serve their customers. Buying power is done in one of a number of ways. The first is building power plants and producing it. The other is buying it on the market from other people who produce it and buy it to put on their lines to serve their customers. And the other, and the cheapest, is to reduce usage. And so energy efficiency is a resource. Some people sort of semi-humorously call them negawatts, actually reducing the amount of power that is needed. And so the cheapest kilowatt hour, megawatt hour, is the one that you don't have to produce in the first place. That's what efficiency does. And you can get efficiency at a much cheaper cost at, 1, 2, and 3 cents a kilowatt hour. Than producing it or buying it. I will say that the low cost of gas is making that somewhat problematic, but even with the low cost of gas, savings in the industrial sector are even cheaper than that. And if we are leaving those resources on the table, we will be buying resources either from the market or building power plants to produce those resources at a much more expensive rate. And so we can either acquire that power cheaply or we can acquire it more expensively, and the cheapest way to do it is through energy efficiency.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I really appreciate it.
Please continue this.
Yeah, so the assertion that you can get for 1, 2, and 3 cents is of great interest to me, because these projects that we can't look at apparently all meet that standard. Is that a correct assertion on my part? That we're going to this conservation effort is going to only cost us 1, 2 to 3 cents. Is that what I'm hearing? And may I anticipate that when you bring me these things that you say exist that you just finished, we're going to look at a 1, 2, and 3 cent cost savings? Is that what I'm going to see?
I can say that the assertion on the on what we have just done will meet that. I can say that it is a safe supposition on what is coming, but I haven't. I'm not privy to the information about the potential savings, but yes, you can. You will see that the very recent projects are very cheap.
And my last question.
Please, Representative.
Great time, Mr. Chair. The limited research I've done on this suggests that the cost of conservation is actually in the neighborhood of a small number all the way up to 9 cents. And so, in fact, the national average is somewhere north of 5 cents. And so it's going to be interesting to see how we have achieved 1, 2, and 3 cents. So I'm looking forward to looking at the materials.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Some of us, Representative Reardon and I and other legislators, had a chance to attend the Legislative Energy Horizons Institute up in Richland this past summer, and it was clearly spelled out there that the best bang for the buck when it comes to efficiencies and conservation measures is within the industrial sector. It's not on the residential side. We've also had a lot of information or coverage lately about regarding the ETO, and I think how, I guess, an easy way to characterize would be the low-hanging fruit on the residential side has pretty much been taken, that now we're more into comfort measures, quality of life, air measures, and so forth and so on. So I guess my question would be, why would it not be within everybody's best interest to shift more of those existing ETO resources into the industrial realm, where we know the bang for the buck is, and the savings are there, as you clearly quantify. So why is that not a good idea? Yeah, because what you're asking here is to lift the cap that's been in place for quite some time, since 2008, I guess, or 7, which is going to have some impacts on our resident, on our industrial sector within the state of Oregon.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Johnson, a couple of questions or a couple of responses to that. One is that while there is an equity policy in place around the public purpose charge, that is not a dollar for dollar. It's, you know, generally people should get something out close to what they put in. Back a number of years ago, when Blue Heron was struggling, it was one of the first kind of big industrial projects, and you know, there wasn't the money in the industrial sector to do that. We moved money over from the residential and commercial sector to make that happen because the savings were so cheap, because it was such a big deal. While the ultimate fate of the Blue Heron plant is unfortunate, it added a little bit more life and kept jobs and sort of kept the that part of the economic impact of Oregon City intact for that much longer. You know, we could have saved that same amount of power by having the plant go out of business, but that wouldn't have been the right thing to do, both, you know, socially or really from an energy standpoint. But at the same time, there is that equity, equity theory in place, where if you're paying in for something, you should get something out of it. And so, you know, your constituents and other constituents of legislators say, you know, we put something in, we want to get something out for our homes, and you know, overall, a lot, you know, we've done so well over the past decade or so in efficiency, all of the low-hanging fruit is drying up. And so we need to keep going up that that tree. Again, if the what people were putting in, people and companies were putting in, were closer, again, 5.5-6% of the bill for residential customers and commercial customers were closer to what industrial customers are putting in, we could talk about that. But there is that's too much of a disparity between 6% and 3%, and the difference is not the public purpose charge. That's sort of semi-equally allocated. The difference is the 838 funding, and that is charged. You know, what goes for residential customers is charged to residential customers. What goes to commercial customers is charged to commercial customers. So there is that direct benefit. The one place that, you know, we seem to be getting benefits, but nobody or not enough being put in is industrial sector, and that's the imbalance that we're trying to correct.
Well, I guess as you talk about getting something out of it or getting a return back on the investment, again, if we're talking about this from the sum total perspective of utility rates region-wide, they will get that return on the investment. And so I guess what I would choose to put the investment in would be that heavy industrial side. We're talking the boilers, the big capital items versus the culp guns. That's the image that I see. So I think we've done a lot of that. The low-hanging fruit's gone. So if we're going to allocate everybody's resources in a way that's going to benefit the region, which is, I think, the intended impact is to keep our rates as low as possible, to not have to build that next plant or whatever, that it would seem to me that we would collectively want to incentivize that and to make sure that that happens. And I think there's enough resources available already to make that happen. That would be my point.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I think that that is an excellent point. And during the PGE rate case, we actually raised that issue. The problem is that we don't allocate the benefits from energy efficiency the same way we do as other hard resources. And so as sort of an intellectual exercise, we put together a marginal cost model to say, okay, the residential customers will be the deep pocket on this, but we have to get the benefit of the resource in the same way that we do with any other resource that we invest in, that we do the same thing on. And when we put together the model for that, what that meant is that residential rates would go down by about 2%, and industrial rates would go up 17%. And so we can do exactly what you're saying, but what we'd have to do is say we have to allocate the benefit of that resource the same way we do as a gas plant, as a wind farm, as a solar generator. And when you do that, it is very clear that there's a value to that resource. And if you're expecting a customer group to pay for that value, they should get that value, but that is going to have an economic impact. Now, nobody is saying that the industrial class should have a 17% rate increase. That's ridiculous. But what we are saying is that paying for another couple of percent for efficiency saves that class money, does save everybody money. There is value in that. There is value in that resource, and we should recognize it.
Rep. Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I told you I wasn't going to ask a question, but you perked a question because you said that Blue Heron Paper did not shut down from just because rate increases and everything, and I know what happened in that mill. So I would like you to tell the committee what went because it did. They went to a chemical process, and they shut down those 12,000 horsepower refiners, some things there to help reduce the energy cost. But I think you should explain to the committee what happened, because that mill is no longer in operation, and there are lots of upgrades that needed to happen. And it was a lot of taxpayer dollars that were put into something that then were used for, nursed it along for another year, maybe 2 years before they'd shut. No, I guess it's about 2 years.
No, actually, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Widener, it was probably, and you may have a better sense, but in my thinking, it was probably at least 5 years, maybe a little bit longer. And I think that the efforts to make Blue Heron more efficient was an important effort. I think it was an attempt to buy time so that to help make the plant more competitive in a very competitive global economy. I think that it did that, And again, I am no expert in terms of Blue Heron's business or their impact on or the competition they face globally. But I think there is a lot of a lot of reasons for the plant's eventual demise, but it was definitely not for a lack of trying on both taxpayers' part and ratepayers' part.
And Mr. Chair, if I may follow up with that.
A short one, if we may. I'm going to get this moving. We have other guests.
One of the other things, there was a turbine that was there that was taken offline, and it was when we were doing a lot of this stuff, where I believe PGE bought the hydro turbine that was there so they could say that they were basically taking a dam out or something like that had happened at the same point. Do you recall any
I don't recall that
as well? So, but this is information. There's some of the, here we had power generation that we just took offline that we shouldn't have with an old turbine that was there that could have been running the plant. So I just want to say some of the things and decisions we've made don't make sense at times. And I'll leave it alone at that, but I know the Blue Heron situation pretty well because I had a lot of friends who were laid off from there, and I've done a lot of work in that plant.
Any other question? So my question, it keeps kind of spinning around, is trying to get a handle on the residential versus commercial, and maybe I'm just way oversimplifying things, but as a residential person, I'm just strapped for cash, and I'm trying to get some help to maybe insulate my house. But if I'm on a commercial side, I might make investments on my own volition just because it's going to get a better return to the bottom line. So is that, and one, is that an accurate model? And then two is, how much help does a person get or a company get on a commercial side? Is it 10% of a project or 50, or do we know?
Mr. Chair, first of all, your general direction is correct. The decision making on a residential scale versus a commercial scale, and then the industrial scale. So, commercial and industrial are two separate classes. Obviously, running a business, a lot of the same thought goes into it, but it's on a much larger scale in the industrial sector. In terms of your second question, I have to say that I represent the residential class. I'm not as familiar with the benefits and incentives that are available on the commercial side.
We have some commercial and industrial and strength folks coming up. So
excellent.
Anything else? Well, thank you very much. Very helpful.
Thank you for hearing.
And you know who's, are they all just a couple at a time, you think? Or?
No, do these two.
Okay. Could we have Roxanne Ross and J.L. Wilson, please? Okay. Ms. Ross, I'll let you go ahead and start if you will.
My name is Roxanne Ross. I live in Gresham. And I'm just the average person, raised two kids, single parent. And we have watched our electric bills go up and up and up. And and a lot of it has been for various programs instituted by the legislature. So and it gets passed on to us, net metering passed on to us, right? There's been a number of them. And when you talk about it getting absorbed by the commercial, you have to remember that we're also consumers. And the commercial businesses are just going to raise, when their rates go up, they raise it, and our costs go up. And to a similar extent with the industrial, right? So we just passed the low carbon fuel standard, and we're looking at, we're probably going to pay quite a bit more for our food now. And just every time I come down here, I'm just amazed at how you just keep passing on more costs to us. And it's easy to pass it on to somebody else, you know. And you want to be able to go back and say, we found the funds for this, we found the funds for that. And especially if it's hidden, you know. If you can pass it on to the ratepayers and we don't see it taken out of our paychecks in a tax, taken out of our paychecks, we may not even realize it's you. Ask the average person what that public purpose charge is. Ask the average person where the Energy Trust gets their money, or why some people get to benefit from what the Energy Trust does and others don't. Ask people what some of the various little things on the back of our bills go to, on our electric bill and our gas bill. And you'll see that you've been sticking it to us. It's just not fair. We just keep paying more and more for all of your wonderful energy ideas and all of your wonderful let's be green. But it really is just not fair. And one of these days, I was born here, raised here, I'll have to leave Oregon and go to a state where we have more level-headed legislators that don't want to stick it to the average Joe.
Thank you for your comments.
Mr. Chair, I might. Thank you. Thanks for coming and everything, but I don't know, your comments were a little bit broad. I don't know what company you are served by, but unless you're West Oregon Electric, that's the most expensive power, and I'm on it. And it's the most expensive because they still pay into the WHOOPS fund, if you can believe that. But in any case, we don't, customers of the co-ops don't benefit from the public purpose fund. It's only the three big ones. So I pay the highest rates, but I still support some of these programs because of what they do to getting us to clean energy, and which will benefit everybody in the long run. And without a longer conversation with you, because you were kind of broad in some of your things. But I would, you know, I'm interested in hearing, I don't know where you live or anything, but I would be interested in hearing more specific how we have damaged you, so to speak. Which program specifically, and how they damage you.
Well, Representative Boone, I'll send you a copy of my electric bill and my gas bill, and I'll show you all these little things. When you look on the back page, they have all these little things that have been tacked on and for clean energy. Well, clean energy might be a priority for you, but it's not a priority for everybody. And I know you've got an agenda here, and but that agenda, it doesn't serve everybody, and it takes away a lot of the livability. When you get your increase, your yearly increase at your job, it's more than absorbed by what TriMet goes up. And I live in Gresham. I believe I said that at the beginning. It's all the different increases. You've got TriMet. You've got what your electric bill goes up. You have what your food bill goes up. You have what your gas bill goes up. And this session, you guys are making a lot of stuff go up. A lot of stuff go up. And I'm going to do my best to tell all my friends and everyone I know what you guys have been doing down here and how much things are going to go up. Because I just don't think that you're thinking about us. I think you're thinking about the programs and your utopia of clean energy, and you're not thinking about the people that have to live here.
Again, follow up.
No, please.
Again, I would ask you to be more specific in that, saying you're going to tell everybody all the things we're doing to do this. And, you know, I think it would be helpful to be
more
specific.
I'll give them bill numbers.
Okay.
Like, yeah. You know, like the low carbon fuel standard.
Okay.
Like, you know, well, I'm interested to see what you do with the net metering, if that's going to be broadened for another 5 years, and how you know, the ratepayers absorb the cost of 11 cents per kilowatt hour instead of 4 on the open market. And there's a bunch. I'd have to make a list for you, but we're watching and we're going to tell all of our friends.
Okay, well, and excuse me, one last final follow-up. I would hope that you're conversing with your representative and senator and letting them know this, because this is the first I've heard of you, and I know that there are things that we consider that do raise costs, and I know that we all consider that, too. It's not fair to say that we don't consider that. I'm glad you came today. This is the first time you've come to our committee that I noticed that you've at least spoken to us. But if we don't hear from people, how will we know? So I hope you are commenting to Representative Peluso. I believe she's your representative.
Oh, yeah. She's our representative.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, thank you very much. Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Chair Reardon, members of the committee. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing Industrial Customers of Northwest Utilities. We represent 160 facilities in the state with more than 170,000 employees. The previous panel, I think, set good context. The public purpose charge was implemented initially in 1999, 3% on your energy bill on all classes of ratepayers, residential, commercial, and industrial. With Senate Bill 838 in 2007, the legislature authorized additional charges on commercial and residential, but not on industrial. But where we differ from the previous panel is that in order to assure that industrial customers did not benefit from additional funds paid by residential customers, the ETO capped the amount of public purpose charge funding it can provide conservation programs for industrial customers at the average amount that it was before Senate Bill 838 was passed. And in this case, Pacific Core's cap is 27%, PGE's cap is 18%, and these limits have not been reached yet, which means that the ETO is spending less as a percentage on industrial customers today than it did before Senate Bill 838 was passed in 2007. So ICNU opposes House Bill 2946, which seeks to eliminate the 3% public purpose charge cap for industrial users. We actually believe the return on investment in terms of energy efficiency into the system is greater in the current system today than it would be if you lifted the cap, as House Bill 2946 purports to do. The proposed increases in the public purpose charge would result in significant rate increases for industrial customers. We're already facing section 111D rulemaking and compliance costs, which we estimate to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 12% to 17% for our customers. And I think it should also be said that industrial customers are probably the strongest proponents of energy efficiency that you're going to find. And they back up their support for this with action. I don't think you'll see any other class of ratepayer dedicate the tens of millions of dollars, both through the ETO and independent of the ETO, to achieve energy efficiency because it makes sense for their companies and what they want to do and their strategic plan and their long-term energy savings. The ETO spent about $25 million on incentives to large customers in 2013. And because these incentives at most cover about 50% of project costs, that means in 2013, industrial customers spent $25 million of their own money on these projects. And that does not even count the money that was spent independent of ETO projects to engage in energy efficiency projects, again, independent of the ETO. As the previous panel alluded to, and we agree with, the ETO recognizes that large customer conservation projects are where you glean the most savings. In fact, it's 2.5 times more cost-effective to engage in industrial-side energy efficiency than in residential. One thing, and the reason we make the return on investment argument with regard to the current system generating more return on investment for energy efficiency than what 2946 would propose is because the public purpose charge funding doesn't all go to energy efficiency. So what the bill would purport to do is take one dollar of marginal expenditure that an industrial customer might spend on energy efficiency, which they're doing today, route it through the ETO, it will come back at 56.7 cents on the dollar for energy efficiency and conservation projects. 17.1% goes for renewable resources, 11.7% to weatherization, 14.5% are spent on schools and low-income houses and not toward increased efficiency. So marginal dollars that are spent on energy efficiency projects today, routed through the ETO, come back at less than 60 cents on the dollar for energy efficiency. We believe that the current laws give the ETO flexibility to acquire the most cost-effective energy efficiency each year, and they're doing it within the caps that were set in 2007. So in other words, we don't believe that subsidies are taking place. The 2007 caps have yet to be reached on the industrial side. The ETO has a surplus of revenue at present. And it should also be mentioned that this very same issue, as alluded to before, is pending before the PUC in a docket. So just a few points just to conclude our testimony. We oppose House Bill 2946 because, in our opinion, it represents a simplistic understanding of how energy efficiency is funded in Oregon because it assumes that all energy efficiency is gained through the ETO, when in fact it is not. Some is gained through the ETO, but the reality is industrial customers are spending millions of dollars independent of the ETO to achieve energy efficiency. We oppose 2946 because large customers, again, already independently fund more than their share at a higher level of cost effectiveness than other classes of ratepayers. We oppose 2946 because it would divert funds already being used for energy efficiency and will reduce the funding that large customers have available to pursue their own privately funded cost-effective projects and diminish their ability to pursue these projects. So for those reasons, we oppose House Bill 2946. I brought with me today our counsel, Tyler Peppel with the Davison Van Cleve Law Firm, to get even more detail.
All right. Good afternoon.
Were there any questions for Mr. Wilson, or just go ahead?
Maybe for the committee, do we have his testimony on all this?
I was looking for that.
You know, I'm sorry. I've got it right here. I'll get it.
Great. It'd be useful to keep. Okay.
Glad to.
Yeah. Hey, Tyler.
Good afternoon, Chairman Reardon and members of the committee. I'm here to answer any questions you might have.
Nice one.
Okay. In a hurry. Rep. Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And JL, thank you for your testimony on this because I'm actually involved in the industrial sector. I'm just wondering if it wouldn't make more sense for us to look at targeted ways to make plants. I mean, they're already doing efficiency standards. They're looking at getting rid of air leaks, lots of different things to drive down the cost of energy. But were we incentivized to actually take the Blue Heron situation? I mean, there we went through and changed some digesters and the way they handled their chips or processed the chips, but we didn't do anything about paper machines or anything else that needed to be fixed in that system. If we looked at incentivizing, basically transforming some of our industrial plants or older plants to where we can bring them up to date with new equipment and look at incentivizing that way to make things more efficient, because it still comes to production, what's going out the end of that door, and every new equipment that you buy has energy-efficient motors on them, they have drives. I mean, they're as efficient as they get. If this committee was looking at things like that for the industrial, I guess, clients in the United, or in the state of Oregon, for incentivizing industrial customers to come here and incentivizing retrofits of some of our industrial plants, if that would make more sense than what we're doing now. Obviously, you're opposed to the bill, but if the committee should be looking at something like that.
Thank you, Representative Reardon and Representative Widener. You know, I guess for the purpose of this bill, I think what we're, you know, what I'm trying to say is I don't even know that we need that, Representative. I mean, the reality is the industrial customers are utilizing the ETO, but they're also doing a lot independent of the ETO to get where they need to go because it makes sense for their industry, their cost effectiveness, their cost model, and where they want to go as industry. So I don't, you know, I'm not going to sit here and advocate that the state should give special anything else to industrial, but what I am saying is, you know, compelling more cost into the ETO probably returns less energy efficiency for your dollar than you're getting otherwise today.
Any other questions? Jeff Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair. JL, is there any way to quantify what percentage of the cost of doing business for the industrial and manufacturing sector is in energy?
Yes. Chair Reardon and Representative Johnson, I'm going to talk generally. I mean, one of the things that sets ICNU members apart is that our energy costs are probably number two behind labor in terms of costs of doing business in the state. Mm-hmm. You're talking energy bills that we can't even comprehend. And so when we contemplate public purpose charge, you know, at 3%, that's a big deal. Mm-hmm. So I think what sets our members apart is the disproportionate cost of business of the energy relative to other types of businesses. Yes.
Follow up, I guess. You know, what the bill would do, obviously, is remove the limitation from statute, and that number would then be fixed at some undetermined level by the PUC, which, as you think about a competitive marketplace, and obviously Oregon hopes to compete with other states to be able to land and attract and then maintain business, that would seem to be a fairly unsettling circumstance to create, because folks looking at Oregon as a place to either move into and set up shop or just to maintain a current business model are going to have a hard time factoring in what that cost would be, because at this point in time it would be undetermined. PUC would have the ability to establish what they believe they need to have to make the programs work. So to me it seems like a pretty unsettling proposal here in this bill. So thanks.
Thank you, Chair Reardon and Representative Johnson. I mean, as the previous panel alluded to, the cap was essentially taken off. The other class, the other ratepayers, residential, and you saw what was 3% now was alluded to at 5.5. And 2946 does not contemplate an upper end cap. It contemplates an open ended increase. Correct.
Okay. No other questions. Thank you very much for your testimony. And if you can let us have your. Yeah, that'd be great. And then, Mr. Cosgrove, are you still interested in?
Chair and members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove, representing the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. I will be brief because much of what I would say has been better said by the testimony before you. Just to give you a little bit of context, Northwest Pulp and Paper Association is the 59-year-old trade association of the pulp and paper industry. There are 13 member companies in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, with 16 paper and pulp mills. When I started representing this business several decades ago, there were a lot more, especially a lot more in Oregon. One was mentioned, Oregon City's Blue Heron, but there are several other paper mills we have lost over the years. Energy is one of the top three costs in every one of our plants, and so sensitivity to energy costs is obviously very important. We still employ in the three states in our plants 12,000 predominantly union-backed jobs that pay an average of $75,000 a year plus benefits. So when we lose one of these plants, especially because they often tend to be in smaller and rural communities, it is a huge loss to the economy and to the social fabric of those communities. We oppose 2946 for the reasons you've heard. We do spend far more than 3% that goes to ETO on energy efficiency. Our plants are almost all, at least partially, if not completely funded, but powered by biomass, which is using wood waste and often in combined heat and technology, or heat and power plants that are very efficient. And those are the things we've done in order to stay competitive, not just with our neighbors in neighboring states or in the southeast United States, mm-hmm. but paper is actually an international commodity, and we have to compete around the world. This is a tough region to compete in. It used to be that we had lots of raw material to use in these plants. That's when we used to have the wigwam burners that Representative Lively talked about and had a lot of forest products plants. We do not have that as much now, and so we're very sensitive to the increase in energy costs and would respectfully request that you not support House Bill 2946. Happy to answer any questions if I can.
Any questions? Thank you very much for testifying.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Anybody else from the audience? I think we're done.
All right. So I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2946. And I am opening a public hearing on House Bill 3257. And those two.
Off the work session.
Okay. I think if we could have the Wendy and Jeff again, that would be great. When do you leave? Okay.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Gerlitz has a daughter who's having a her 10th birthday this evening, and she wanted to be back in Portland, so she extended her apologies. But she agrees with everything I say, and that's not often the case. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeff Bissonnette with the City and County Board of Oregon, representing residential ratepayers. This bill is fairly straightforward. This is, I think, the third time around that we've pursued this bill. Essentially, what it does is extends sort of the base of $15 million in energy assistance to $20 million, and we first started that about 4 years ago, in the depths of the Great Recession. And the little bit unusual thing is that in the base $15 million, that's kind of spread across all customer classes as sort of a system charge. For the $5 million extra dollars to bring it to $20 million, the residential class is paying for all of that. That's not particularly good policy. That concerned us at the time, but because it was temporary, because it was needed, we agreed to go along with that. 2 years ago, and it was initially for a two-year period to get us through the worst of the economic downturn. 2 years ago, there was interest in extending that. And so, again, we're quite out of the woods, and so we agreed to that, again, raising the issue that it's not good policy, but again, because it's needed, and we're kind of here again. And the reason that we, you know, originally this bill was kind of presented to us as a permanent fixture, we had very strong feelings about that. We really need to make a decision as to whether or not it's a system cost or not, but we are about to launch into a pretty broad discussion at the PUC around low-income bill payment assistance, and we can sort of figure out how the best way to treat that is. And so because this bill, again, is temporary and is for 2 years, we are, and again, because it's needed, even though the economy is definitely doing better than it was 4 years ago, which is not a particularly high bar, the need is still very great, and the agencies that work with these with the folks that need these resources have very compelling stories. And actually, in the testimony in another committee earlier today on another bill, you know, there is definitely a lot of concern about that. So we're here to support that, but again, noting that it is not particularly good policy, but we hope to address the policy issues at the discussion that is getting underway at the PUC. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Rep. Bantz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we increased this, didn't we? It seems like we increased this.
It went from 15 to 20 million. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz. 15 to 20 million 4 years ago for a two-year period, extended it again for 2 years ago for another two-year period, and now this bill is extending it one more time, again, $20 million for another two-year period.
Yeah. I don't remember the policy discussion, but I'm guessing we did have it about who should pay. I don't remember. Do you have a thought what the right thing to do is?
Yeah, I think that I think it is a system charge. Again, it benefits everybody to keep people connected to the system and reduce costs for people going on and off. And so I do think that the better policy route is treating it as a system charge the way we do with the sort of base $15 million. That said, you know, raising it from 15 to 20, you know, is needed. And so we're kind of, you know, looking the other way. But as we look for more permanent, more long-term solutions, we're going to need to sort of revisit that that policy discussion. And that's what we're prepared to do at the PUC.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thank you.
Okay. We have, I guess, Barner and Elizabeth, if you'd like to come up. Ryan, would you like to join them? And who are next to go first?
Sure. Chair Reardon, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Fisher. I'm here today on behalf of the Community Action Partnership of Oregon, which is the statewide network of community action agencies. There are 17 community action agencies which cover all 36 counties in Oregon. They provide a number of services, each a little different depending on the local needs, but all of them provide energy assistance and emergency housing assistance. We are here today in support of this bill. As Mr. Bissonnette referenced, this, the history is that this started 4 years ago. At the time, we hoped that the recession was going to be very quick. We passed a bill that supplemented this by $5 million a year. At the end of that 2 years, the recovery was still not around, and so we extended it for another 2 years. Where we are right now is that we see that while we are getting much better numbers from our economic forecast, the recovery has not been even. And the folks who come into our doors and are needing energy assistance in order to stay in their homes, in order to keep their refrigerators on, their lights on, are still not seeing the wages that they even saw pre-recession. So we're seeing working families that, frankly, don't have enough to cover rent, bills, food, and medicine. So we are very much in favor of extending this. We also would like to look forward to some more comprehensive things that could be done in the future. But we feel that this is extremely important for families that are in crisis right now. Currently, only one in four families that would be eligible for this assistance are able to receive it because we run out. And that's not just this particular charge. That's a combination of federal, state, and ratepayer funds. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Mr. Chair. Ryan, how will we ever define recovery? What will that look like? Because we hear that. We've heard that for a long, long time, since 2008. We're longing for the days when we can say we're out of the hole, out of the ditch, whatever, we've recovered from this recession. But what would you look for from the CAP perspective to say, I mean, we don't need it anymore?
Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Johnson, thank you very much for the question. I think, you know, when I hear your question, I think, well, you could sort of go family by family. What does recovery look like? There are so many families that we hear about that are working full-time, two jobs, and they can't afford a place to live and rent and food. And so when a full-time job is able to cover those pieces for that family, then that, I think, would be the recovery. Our role is to try to make sure that people have their basic needs met, that they have a safe place to live, that they have the power on, and they have that stability upon which they can then do the things that they need to do in order to improve their circumstances. And right now, we don't have there are too many families in Oregon that don't have that. And so that's where I would start with the recovery, is that stability upon which the next pieces can be built.
Just a follow-up. So I guess what I'm hearing is that, you know, there's not an economic number, i.e. an unemployment rate or GDP growth or a measure of indication like that, but just simply demand, right? People you hear from, community, the need, which is really hard to quantify except that it exists. And it exists across the state in a lot of communities and so forth. And I guess my prediction would be that we're never going to see, I don't know how we're ever going to see that go away. It just doesn't seem like there's a trend that's going to eliminate that to the point that you would come to us and say, or anybody would, that we don't need it anymore. Perhaps there could be a phase out or a scale back. I don't know if you've thought about that or what you would recommend at some point in time. But I was here, I think, when we reauthorized the sunset 2 years ago, and I would predict we're going to be here 2 years from now doing the same thing. So thank you. Which is right.
I think Rep. Bantz was first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is a deja vu moment, but the question is, who is in the best position to pay? So do we get the taxpayers to reimburse you for keeping their power on, or do we have the ratepayers bear the burden? And so that brings me to who's in the best position to determine who's cheating, who should be paying, who isn't paying, who should be shut off just because they're losers and spent all their money down, you know, on the lottery, whatever the deal is. This is the discussion, isn't it, that you're going to have at the PUC? Is that what's going to happen? Because we don't have to engage in it here. I mean, we can, but if you're going to have it again down there, are we going to then hear back? Is that kind of the plan?
Chair Reardon, Representative Bentz, it might be that the folks here next to me are more informed about what's going on at the PUC. There is an energy coordinator from the Community Action Agency who participates in those conversations more directly. He wasn't able to be here today, so I'm up here on his behalf. And I would be happy to have him come and talk with you. I would add that the I'll stop with that because I see you have another question.
Please. So my point is this: there is no doubt about the need. That's not the issue. Right. It's the issue is who is in the best position to address the issue, the power company, or should we be having DHS do it? And then the taxpayers would be the broader group that would reimburse the. You see how it would work.
Sure, sure.
And so the initial question is, why is the power company in the business of handing out this type of benefit, or not? That's really the question I'm asking. Are you going to get to this with the PUC?
Chair Reardon and Representative Bentz, there are two points that I would make. One is in terms of who decides who gets it, who doesn't. The community action agencies do the eligibility determination, and so they're the ones who verify that somebody is income eligible, that they meet other requirements. And it's as I said, only one in four that are eligible are receiving it. So from that point, it's first come, first serve. And typically, the money is spent in a very short time at the beginning of the heating season. In terms of your second question, I think there's not a single answer, but I will note, and I'll let the folks up here maybe talk a little bit more in detail about it, but we know that shutoffs are very expensive. It's expensive to send somebody to do the shutoff. It's expensive to send somebody to come and bring them back. Typically, that ends in an eviction for the tenant, which means a write-off for the utility. And so there is some data that we'd be happy to share in the past when this has been studied that shows that it actually lowers costs to be able to be more proactive on these and to avoid those shutoffs and those cost losses.
Very short follow-up, Mr. Chair. We've had this discussion before. This may be the third time, and so I apologize. I was asking, are you going to have this discussion with the PUC? Or do we have to have it here?
Chair Reed, Representative Bentz, the PUC issued a report last week on that had a lot of discussion on this very topic, and I think that the PUC is going to have a robust conversation on this. I'm sorry I didn't better answer your question the first time.
Thank you.
So, I'm sorry. Is there a question?
I did,
Representative Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry if I missed my opportunity to ask the person that may be best equipped to answer this question. But, Ryan, I think you could as well. Do we have an idea of the distribution of folks around the state that are using, that need this help? Is it evenly spread across all the counties? Where are you seeing the most need?
Chair Reardon, Representative Helm, what I would love to do is bring you a document that Community Action puts together annually, which is called the Energy Snapshot, and it has a lot of data that speaks to that. I would say that for this particular bill, this only impacts PacifiCorp and Pacific Power territory. So it doesn't get to every, this particular piece doesn't get to every county. There are other energy assistance programs that are administered by the community action agencies that cover the entire state.
Okay. I'd like that. Thank you.
Absolutely.
I would too.
I'll provide the report to the committee, and I'm happy to meet with any of you.
That'd be great. Thank you very much. I'm really shocked that we can only meet 1 in 4 requests, and we are so far away from being out of the recession, and you and I were on the hunger task force and worked on that together, and when the employment rate is going down, but the number of people still looking for food boxes is still on an increase, we've got work to do, so thank you for your work. Rep Holby.
Yeah, I got to go back to 101 here for a second on this particular topic. So the money for this fund comes from the IOUs, and is it, I assume, and the monies that are, the people that receive this benefit are in your territory, so this doesn't really have anything to do with poor people in other parts of the state that are under Publix, perhaps?
Chair Reardon, Representative Holby, I'll make a quick answer and let PGE perhaps address it as well. The way that this is structured is that the funds that are raised in PacifiCorp territory from PacifiCorp customers, those are allocated to customers within the PacifiCorp territory as well. Same with PGE. As I mentioned, the community action agencies also administer federal funds for energy assistance, and those are distributed statewide.
Follow up?
Yes.
Are there other, I guess, do the Publix also have similar programs? I don't see them in the room. I'm just curious.
Chair Reardon, Representative Holby, I am aware that many of them do. I am not knowledgeable enough to know if all of them do. Again, our energy coordinator probably would be able to answer that much more specifically.
I was just follow up one last time. I was just figuring how, you know, how they compare with, you know, investments, that's all.
Mm-hmm.
And benefits to the low income people.
Well, and thank you for that question. And Ryan, if it would be possible, or I don't know if it's, you'd be providing it, if we could find out what the other providers do, is that? I'll work on that with my administrator. Thank you. Mr. Seaman.
Chair Reardon, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman, representing Portland General Electric. Going to switch up here a little bit what I was prepared to say. There are largely two buckets of money that are available for low-income bill payment assistance. One is federal money through the LIHEAP program. That money is given from the federal government to Oregon Housing Community Services, and that money is available statewide for all customers of all utilities, regardless of fuel type. The second state statute bucket of money available for these types of programs comes from two sources. The first is from Senate Bill 1149 that was passed in 1999 that folks were talking about earlier that established the public purpose charge. A portion of the money that we collect as Portland General Electric and PacifiCorp that we collect from customers, we essentially take that money and then pass that on to Oregon Housing Community Services in a program that's called OEAP, or the Oregon Energy Assistance Program. Mr. Bissonnette earlier was talking about $15 million. That's the amount of money per Senate Bill 1149 that is collected for OEAP. What we're talking about here in HB 3257 is an additional $5 million on a meter charge basis. So for me as a PGE customer, I have a monthly charge on my bill. It's pretty de minimis. It's about 25 cents for me as a PGE customer. That money is collected, bundled with the other OEAP money. It's given to Oregon Housing Community Services, given to the CAPS, and then used for administration of bill payment assistance by the community action agencies that Ryan represents. That money, the OEAP money, given that it's collected by the investor-owned utilities, is only spent for customers of the investor-owned utilities. And I can't speak to what happens outside of our service territory. When we look at the question of bill payment assistance for us as a utility, and I think one of the questions is, well, why should we extend this program? I think that's the rational question among legislators. In our service territory, our folks say that we were able to serve about 1 in 5 folks who are eligible for assistance. Who qualify for assistance, there are funds available to assist those people. We are supportive of extending these funds in the form of HB 3257, not because we think that solves the problem, but we think that it provides some benefit for folks who are struggling to pay their bills. As a committee who's had to suffer through hearing the investor-owned utilities come in and complain about costs of measures many times before, this is one of the reasons why we complain about costs, is we have and new measures that could potentially raise costs, is we do see a pretty high need among our customers, and we do have some concern about the costs that are passed on. I think the earlier conversation about what's the impact on industrial customers, similar conversation, this is on the residential customers. We do pay attention to that. We are concerned about what the costs are that we're passing on. With that said, when we look at bill payment assistance, and Ryan is right, it's more efficient to help people keep their lights on than it is to have people face shutoffs. But essentially, from a utility perspective, it doesn't make, from a crass kind of bottom line perspective, it doesn't make a huge difference to us in terms of, do we do the bill payment assistance up front, collect that fees, pass it through to customers and have them be able to pay their bills, or simply have shutoffs and have bad debt on our system. If we have bad debt on our system that we write off, that's an expense for us. It gets rolled back into rates. So from a profitability of the utility standpoint, there's really no difference. We're advocating for this program. There's no difference between passing this extension and not passing this extension in terms of our bottom line. For our customers, though, we think that it's better policy to avoid those disruptions and figure out a way that we can help people keep the lights on rather than having people go into a situation where they're not able to pay, where they go into a situation of bad debt, facing collections, those types of things. So that's basically the short version of why we're supportive of this program.
Rick Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Varner, I supported these when they came through before, and I think one of the things that probably should touch on is, I mean, I think it actually costs less to run this program versus going out and doing the shutoff, just because the expense of having to turn the power off, turn it back on, and the delay and everything else. So I think this was a more economical way. I supported it because we had the triggers, and I think that's what we're discussing right now, is those triggers aren't triggering for this, so we have to decide if the program's going to keep going. And I guess that's two questions kind of that I gave you, or two comments, but if you could verify those, because that was my reasoning for it, is just because I know what it costs to send a guy out there near probably $300 to just go shut the power off for somebody.
Chair Reardon, Representative Widener, interestingly, the cost of turning on and off in certain residential settings is avoided by having automatic meters that we have the ability to remotely turn the power on and off. And so through some improvement in the technology that we have for the metering, we do avoid having those vehicle trips. Switching to automated meters has saved us 1.2 million miles of vehicle miles traveled for meter reading within our system. We see that as an advantage. So actually that cost is, we've been able, over through switching out our metering technology, able to reduce that. With that said, it's still doing collections, having folks go into arrears is still more inefficient than providing that assistance. And so I agree, this is a more efficient way to administer the programs than not administer the programs. I think to the second question about whether or not we've hit those economic triggers, I agree, we haven't reached a point where we don't need these programs.
So, Mr. Seaman, you're only serving 1 in 5, and there's no economic pain to the company for doing this. Is there sort of a higher limit that you might like to go to?
Chair Reardon, in terms of higher limit,
provide additional funding for these programs.
Well, that's what we're looking at doing in the PUC docket. I think that there becomes a question of, and just to draw the distinction, this is money that's collected from customers and then rebated to other customers. It's essentially a pass-through for us. There is a cost to customers who are paying in for the benefit of other customers, and that's where the threshold is. And so I think that that's an appropriate conversation to take place for our economic regulators and the various stakeholders sitting behind me in the room to have that conversation. One last note, for the total of OEAP-funded programs in our system that go to benefit residential customers, 63% of the funds for those programs come from residential customers. The remaining 37% come from commercial and industrial customers in our system. Thank you.
Chair Reardon, members of the committee, I'm Elizabeth Howe, representing PacifiCorp. I think there was some PacifiCorp supports this legislation for all the reasons you've heard already this afternoon. There was some comment about other areas of the state. Pacific Power does serve mainly rural areas of the state, so that economic need that maybe the recovery that's happening in the metropolitan areas that may not be out in rural Oregon, we are feeling that, and that's one of the reasons we support this for our customers who are still struggling maybe more than others. And then Representative Widener, if I could follow up on the economic triggers question, we actually took them out of the bill last session in House Bill 2004 or in the 2 years ago. Mainly because they were somewhat difficult to administer, but also because there was no way we were ever going to meet the need. Right. So the 1 in 4, the 1 in 5 question is, the need's going to be there. Hopefully, upon recovery, whatever that looks like, it's not as great. But as we know, and as has been stated, there is always going to be a population of people in Oregon who are going to need assistance. And so hopefully at this PUC docket, we'll be able to figure out the best way to help people stay warm and cozy in their homes and the best way to fund that. So thank you.
Any last questions? Okay, thank you all for help being here and for your support of this program. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
I am closing public hearing on House Bill 3257. And unless there are any objections, I am closing the meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee.
1 minute early. I say early. 1 minute early.